Hello, tennis fans, and welcome to another edition of the OTA's On Tennis podcast series. Today, we're happy to welcome our special guest, Arash Madani. A native of Truro, Nova Scotia, Arash began his broadcast career with Sportsnet 2009. He's traveled the globe covering major sports news, stories, and features. Assignments in his broadcasting career at Sportsnet have included the Winter and Summer Olympics, the Super Bowl, the World Series, the NBA Finals, the Stanley Cup Finals, and in 2017, he was awarded the George Gross Award as Canada's top sports broadcaster of the year.
That is one heck of an introduction. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
So I'm sure you noticed I purposely left your tennis coverage, all the sports you've done over the years. I personally left the tennis coverage for the end because that's what we're here to talk about today. And it struck me, and I've watched you many times on the air and even in person at the tournament. You seem to have a passion for the sport that maybe goes beyond your reporting instincts. In other words, you kind of like the sport.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I grew up on the mean courts of the Truro Tennis Club in Truro, Nova Scotia in Victoria Park. That's, my mom always joked that I used to 9 to 5 it there. In the mornings, growing up, bike down to the tennis club, lessons in the morning, hit in the morning, have some lunch, usually play cards in the clubhouse, and then hit some more in the afternoon and come back. I was never any good. I just really enjoyed it. There was a group of us, like, I don't know, 20 of us, maybe 25 of us, who would kind of do that during the weekdays. And my mom played, my parents always watched, tennis was on in the house. And when I joined Sportsnet, you mentioned in 2009, I think in 2011, Sportsnet got tennis rights and Milos kind of exploded onto the scene. I jumped at the opportunity to get a chance to cover it. And here we are 12 years later, and I just had the opportunity to call the Billie Jean King Cup. So it's just been an amazing little run of getting to cover tennis, getting to be around tennis, and what a time to be around Canadian tennis with everything that's gone on.
I would agree. Your timing was impeccable because Milos kind of,
all by accident.
Yeah, amazing. But I mean, Daniel set the stage, you know, a generation before, but even as you were starting your broadcaster, he was kind of still at his height and playing Davis Cup for Canada and winning majors. And then, of course, it's exploded in the last 10 years. So, yeah, your timing's been good, but interesting to hear your background. I didn't realize you played as a kid because you don't talk to a lot of people from Nova Scotia who have played a lot of tennis, but that's really cool. So there's a little community club, I guess, Gather in Truro that you started out?
There is, and it's amazing now. Like when we were growing up, there were 4 courts at the park, 2 courts at the college, and 1 beat up court at the high school. And now, beside our high school, there's a place called the Cougar Dome that's, you know, a bubble. And there are 2 kids from Truro, both just went to nationals. One was the co-winner, I guess, in dubs of the under 12. And another is on his way to join the National Training Center program in Montreal.
That is impressive, actually.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And it's amazing what facilities and coaching can do, because there was at least one kid that I grew up with that I always thought, probably maybe 2, but one for sure, that I always thought, man, If the infrastructure was here in rural Nova Scotia, Jody could be something, and it just wasn't there. And now there is, and we're seeing the first kind of alumni of that program getting a real shot.
A real shot, definitely. Yeah, I mean, you've. I've actually seen you play up at the
I'm so sorry.
Roger. No, I was impressed. You have a wick, powerful forehand. I thought you looked pretty good. So, are you playing currently? Like, do you keep the game up now?
I try in the winter to get out once a week at least. I see Glenn all the time at Eglinton Flats.
The Flats.
get out to 10X from time to time, but in the summer I'll play anywhere and everywhere. And during COVID, played a ton when there was nothing else to do and weren't really traveling and anything like that. But I try and get out twice a week in the summer and once a week in the winter.
Good for you. Well, we'll have to have you back up to the stadium then to try.
All the help I can get. So whatever you got, I'm down.
Good stuff. When I've watched you over the years, particularly for tennis, I've noticed that you know, as I said earlier, the passion for the sport does come through, and now I know why. But I really think that you do have a soft spot too for the Canadian tennis scene, like for the players. I mean, obviously it's part of your job to cover Canadian tennis, but it just seems that some of the, seem to really get to know the people behind the player, and you know, your passion for the sport comes through as well as the Canadian tennis scene. I think also that you like to, your style seems to be not just reporting who won and who lost and that sort of thing, but you like to get behind the scenes and get into the emotional side of the play. So can you give us some thoughts about some of the current young stars like Dennis and Bianca and Felix, and, you know, what you see when you're, you know, maybe observing them before an interview or during an interview over and above that? Oh, yeah, great match last night.
So I'm very lucky and thankful and appreciative of the original Davis Cup format, because we started doing Davis Cups around 2011, and Sportsnet made a real investment in those days. Like, we went to Tel Aviv when they were in a World Group qualifier and finally got over the hump. And the players and the coaches and the captain at the time, Marty Lorando, couldn't believe that not only was this going to be televised again after a long hiatus, but that we were there. And it felt like the event and our coverage grew and grew. We do sit down interviews with the players, but I'd get there on like a Monday for a tie that would begin Friday. And I just became kind of part of the furniture around the team. And then think of the team. Milos, Vasek, Daniel, Frank. So you're around these guys, and there's a rapport and a trust that gets built. And those guys were so good. You know, Polanski was in the mix, and Jesse Levine for a little while, and on we can go about names. But the guys were so good with me and giving their time and being so open. And like, you're talking about best of five matches, right? So there's a lot of canvas that you can fill telling stories about people. Everything from their racket change, what kind of tension they're using, what their coaching change was all about, what their points of emphasis were, all the way to personal interest stuff. And, you know, they did a court commemoration for Vasek in Vancouver. And not only were we there with a camera, whatever, but I got to host it and I got to meet some of the people who were involved in Vasek's kind of tennis upbringing. And getting to tell these stories on air allows Canadian tennis fans, Canadian sports fans, to learn more about these athletes and how they've gotten to this spot. Because so often in tennis, you see them at a slam, you see them at a 1,000, then they kind of disappear kind of off the radar, but their run continues and we don't get that side of it. And so that's what I try and provide when we do these events, is really allow, and that's why the Canadian thing to me is so great, is that really allow Canadian sports fans, Canadian tennis fans, to learn more about these players and kind of what makes them tick.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think you do a great job with that. And I think they really want to tell the story too, because, you know, it's an underdog nation in terms of tennis. It has been for a long time, and they're kind of the trailblazers, beginning with the folks like Daniel. So I think, it seems to me at least, that they have that Canadianism in them that makes them want to talk a little bit more than maybe a road athlete who just says, you know, oh, I got to win the game, you know?
Right. And there's a familiarity and there's a comfort and there's a trust. And so, like, just kind of being around, you know, we were in Belgium in 2015 for a quarterfinal there, Davis Cup, and that's where I first met Dennis, you know? And suddenly, 2 years later, there he is knocking off Rafa, and you're saying, what the heck just happened? Here's this kid running into the water in Ostend, Belgium, with a flag around him for his initiation. But, you know, once you're around, they get to know you, they see what you're about, Dennis and Felix and the rest. It's a big help.
Yeah, and you know, I think you made an excellent point about the old format where it was zonal and it was one weekend, two teams, you know, 8-10 guys.
Home court advantage.
Home court advantage. I mean, the noise and the spirit of those, some of those events that I've been to and I know you've covered, have been off the charts in terms of just adding that extra value other than just a great tennis match. It was like national pride and the emotion was high. And you could just see the players being lifted by it. Just give me some of your thoughts on some of the ones you've covered over the years, good and bad, because we all remember Ottawa as well when it ended very suddenly. But yeah, just give us a flavor of just being, you know, just more than even what you just said, being around that whole week and the whole scene.
Yeah, I mean, the finish in Ottawa was brutal, but like the weekend was incredible. And, you know, like good friends of mine, a buddy of mine from university and his wife, they'd never been to a tennis event before. And I invited them out and they came and they had such a good time that I think it was the next year when Canada was home to the Netherlands at Ricoh, they made the trip from Ottawa and came for the weekend.
Wow.
Because it's drums, it's music, it's chants, it's song, it's waving the flag, it's beating the chest, it's everything that you'd want to have in a great sport environment. And that's what makes it neat. Now, that said, so we're in Toluca, Mexico in 2011, and Milos's then coach Gallo Blanco is on the Canadian coaching staff, and he's getting into an argument with the tournament referee, and the next thing you know, these armed dudes with machine guns show up and they're like, you're out of here. And Gallo was trying to put up a fight, and I'm like, Gallo, the machine gun always wins, you know? We're in Tel Aviv in 2011, and one of the players, I think it was Dudi Sela, I can't remember, like climbed the umpire's chair and like pointing his index finger in his face. I'm like, well, that doesn't happen every day. 2013 in Vancouver, the birth of Frank the Tank, when Frank out of nowhere smoked Marcel Granollers. And I give Vasek's brothers all the credit in the world. They recruited like 100 of their friends and buddies and acquaintances and whatever. And they had the drums and the trumpets. And it was rocking in the building. And the chants of Frank the Tank, Frank the Tank. And so Canada out of nowhere upset Spain. And then a couple of months later, upset Italy. And they're going Canada versus Serbia in September in Belgrade, right after the US Open. Like, peak Novak, who had just won in New York, won in New York Sunday, flew Wednesday, showed up to a press conference Thursday, played Friday and Sunday. That's Novak. Peak Janko Tipsarevic. Nenad Zimonjić playing doubles. Like, it was
stacked.
Elite Serbia tennis, right? And the Vasek army showed up. And I remember, I'm getting chills just thinking about it. On the Sunday night, I went out and met up with them. And I was talking to a couple people, and they're like, one of them said, I never had a passport in my life until we beat Italy. And they're like, I couldn't miss this.
Amazing.
And they weren't even a tennis fan, but they had such a great time at Davis Cup. And I thought that was so cool that what makes this these international competitions so special and so unique is that it's so different from everything else. Like, I cover a lot of sports. The closest thing, and it's not even close, was when the Raptors were on the run in 2019.
Right.
You kind of felt that, not necessarily in the building, but all around the city and all around the country. I think that's what makes this whole thing so cool too.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're missing a lot with the lack of zonal play. But let's talk about Davis. While we're on the topic of Davis Cup, we might as well continue. Obviously, Canada has had tremendous success in recent years,
yes.
Reaching the final a year or so ago. And then this year, of course, won it all. So why don't you talk a little bit about what your thoughts were about that whole sort of ascension, I guess, from zone play to world group to competing well to winning.
So I want to go back. So the team won in 22, right? November of 22.
That's right.
Let's go back to November of 2019, the first quote unquote new Davis Cup. So we were out there for the 2 weeks in Madrid, 12 days, whatever it was. And the build as the event went on was wild. And Canada just knocking like one upset after another after another. And on the Saturday night, I can't remember who they beat in the semis, but they won the semis. And so afterwards we're gathering content because like Sunday they're in the final and they're going to play Spain. And like talking to the guys, like just how much it meant to them. And Vasek, who's like lifted a Wimbledon trophy, doubles, but lifted a Wimbledon trophy. He's like, this would be by far the biggest achievement of my, not tennis career, of my life. And so the next day you get to the arena. And again, this is 2019, November. We are 5 months removed from 2 million people downtown with the parade here. And 30 minutes before the match, there's Shakira performing for the opening ceremony, and the King of Spain is in the house, and you could not get a ticket if you tried. My uncle's, he lives in Madrid, he and his wife really wanted to come. Thankfully, there was an allotment from Tennis Canada, and there were two tickets left from there, but outside of that, like, you could not get a seat. And it was so loud in our on-cam hit before the match has started. Like, I just looked in the camera and I could not hear in my earpiece the cues. And so our camera guy, Mario Fontana, he had, you know, his hands over his headsets and just kind of pointed at me. And I remember looking into the camera and Brad Fay was our host, and Brad had covered the Raptors deal too. And I just said, Brad, it's loud in here. It's Steph Curry at the free throw line, game five loud. Like, that's what it was. And they're in Madrid against Rafa. Roberto Bautista Agut, at the time, was a top 10 player. Bautista Agut's father had died that week. He left the team. He came back to play the final. And Dennis, afterwards, he lost to Nadal. He was so pissed. They weren't happy getting to the finals. He was mad. Not angry, not disappointed. He was pissed. And I remember leaving the building that night saying to myself, these dudes are going to win, and they're going to win soon. And sure enough, that you know, Vasek played the dubs, and Vasek was around. He was kind of the OG. But Felix and Dennis made a vow to themselves, to each other, when they won the Junior Davis Cup, that they were going to do this. And the three of them were instrumental in that happening, and it was just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, Vasek was, you know, kind of a, considered the journeyman. And then every time Davis Cup called, that guy is, him and, you know, Frank did it once. That guy does it every time he plays. He's something to watch. And you just can't help but like that guy. I mean, he's just such a nice young man.
He's a likable character.
Yeah, but he's a steely competitor.
He really is. And I'll tell you what, I don't like to tell tales out of school, but...
tell us one.
Well, we didn't cover that one. Of all the ones we didn't go to, they win it. And he sent me a text when they got back. He wrote, yeah, November 28th, a few days after. Biggest moment of my career, very emotional day, weight lifted to, wanted this one so badly. And I thought that really captured Vasek how much that meant. So,
yeah, definitely.
It was great.
Well, so let's segue. I mean, we could talk. Well, actually, one thing about Davis Cup, I did happen to watch you and the team from Tennis Canada, including Frank, launch the cross-country Davis Cup tour, which I guess is underway now. It was a terrific, actually, afternoon. It was really nice. I thought you brought a lot out from the player, you know, from Frank and the other folks there. It seems like the Davis Cup trophy is quite something to look at, isn't it? It's amazing. It's so different. And, you know, when a player or a coach in this case accompanies it, I think it really brings it home how important it was, because it may never happen again. We don't know. I mean, I think we have a good couple of years left with the current guys, but we don't know what the future is. So I think
Rogers won it once.
Yep.
Novak's won it once.
Right.
Canada's won.
That's right. Yeah, you're right. And, you know, U.S. has won like 30 times and Australia 28 times. And so, yeah, there's not too many countries that win it. So it's certainly a great achievement and, you know, one we can hope for. But this cross-country tour, we're, you know, obviously Tennis Canada is taking it right across Canada from one coast to the other, going to clubs and, you know, community centers and that sort of thing. It's kind of like a mini Stanley Cup tour, if you will, you know. But I think...
when the Olympic torch would come,
yeah,
come through.
That's right.
Something like that.
Yeah, I think the smaller the city, frankly, the bigger a deal it will be. You know, if they get to Niagara Falls and Frank happens to be there, I think that would be wonderful. But I can see it really motivating some of the young Canadian tennis players, like looking back to your time in Truro, if something like that had happened in a small town like that for you tennis folks, I think it would probably help motivate. It's certainly been on TV, but I just think something like that is very symbolic.
It, because you can look at it and see it and realize this is a possibility. Like I'm so lucky in getting to do what I do, but I just, you know, I could not believe for the life of me. I got sent to Wimbledon and there's Milos in the semifinals of Wimbledon on center court against Roger. And then the next day there's Bouchard against Kvitova in the Wimbledon final. Like I never could have fathomed the day that could have even been possible, let alone a reality. And then you fast forward to 2019 and there's Bianca lifting the trophy in New York. Like it was overwhelming to see that as a Canadian. And now this trophy that is going to go in all these communities and that a lot of young kids are going to see this. These are all not possibilities. These are not all just what could be. It's what is. And I think all of that is so important.
Now, you recently, of course, covered the women's side of it, the Billie Jean King Cup. Canada just played Belgium in Vancouver, I think, last weekend. So what are your thoughts on that side of it? You know, do you think, they haven't had the success of the men, but I think, you know, do you think a breakthrough is possible? I mean, the format isn't the worst for it. You know, you have one or two good players, and we certainly do. You could do some damage.
I absolutely do. I think that Canada is in a great spot. Look, think about, like, let's just like rewind the clock a generation. If the world number 27 for Canada was missing, how catastrophic that would be. And instead, as brutal as it was that Bianca wasn't in the mix, Layla took care of business. You know, this is as if Bianca, if everybody plays, this is the team that nobody wants to play. This is the team that nobody wants to go up against. That world number six ranking that the women's national team has going into the Billie Jean King Cup final is not only legit, it may even be underselling them because you have three top 100 players. Layla's 50 in the world right now, but playing at a much higher level. Like the rankings are the rankings, yeah. Whatever. She's got, well, she didn't play grass court season last year, so she's got a ton of runway here to increase the points. You know, just last August, she's 13 in the world, and she's finally looking right from a health standpoint.
Yeah.
Remember, it was at the French Open last year, she had the foot injury and it knocked her out. So she's, and you forget, she's only 20. They're in a really good spot. And I actually truly believe that Layla's got a real opportunity over this next little bit to do some damage.
She's a very focused young player. I mean, it's amazing, you know, because she's smaller than most of the people she plays against, but she is, you know, the eye of a tiger and the heart of a lion. You know, it's amazing to watch her compete. I just think, and I think that's infectious. I think the other teams can rub off that. So this
thing Heidi said, the captain, Heidi,
yeah.
She said when Layla showed up for our Billie Jean King Cup team, and she was 16, and she was a bulldog and she was fearless then. She's a bulldog and she's fearless now.
Yeah.
But she's really worked on her serve. The radar gun's up to 109. And one of the interesting things Layla said, because she said, look, she admitted the first quarter of her season was not great. Her goal is to get back into the top 20 and get that ranking up. but I thought this was really interesting. She said, outside of two matches, I haven't been blown off the court at all this year. And she said, I need to be more dialed in during key moments. I just can't make mistakes in the big moments. And part of the reason why the serve has been such a point of emphasis, why she's wanted to improve it, and she has. Part of it was the injury too. She's like, I just realized that I'm not going to out-rally people all the time. I can't. I need to add more to my game. And for a 20-year-old to understand all of that, and to try and develop that serve into becoming more of a weapon, I think that's really important.
Yeah, I think she is the most complete tennis player in terms of the physical. Like, she doesn't have some of the attributes of a 5'8" woman who can serve at 120, but she compensates, and emotionally and mentally she's with it, and her tennis IQ I think is very high. So I agree with you. I think she can go a long way with what she's got, and she's so determined, it's amazing. Like, yeah, she's never out of a match. So give us a little bit about, like, we talked at length about the locker room and the background in between matches for the Davis Cup over the years. What was it like in Vancouver with the ladies team? What was the dynamic like? And again, it's such an individual sport. These women, they see each other, but like, they may be playing each other the next day, so they can't really get all that friendly. But what was it like that week in Vancouver, or that weekend?
We called it from studio here.
Okay.
Okay. I've been around the team before. Last year, for instance, we were in Vancouver for it. They do generally like each other. They genuinely like each other. In a team environment, that matters. That's significant. There's a trust there. There's a belief there. Look, we interviewed Rebecca Marino on Saturday. She was pissed that she didn't get a chance to play, but she said, look, I respect the captain's decision. They went with Catherine Sebov. I think there's a real chemistry that Dabrowski and Fernandez have together as a doubles team. And look, Bianca was hurt. Bianca has a bad ankle. And Bianca showed up to Vancouver. Now, there were some business reasons why she was there too, but she sat courtside for every match. And when we spoke with her, she was like, it's nerve-wracking being there. So, like, they care.
Yeah.
And that matters a lot.
Yeah. Actually, you mentioned Dabrowski, Gabby. I mean, she has been the Daniel Nestor of the Billie Jean King Cup for a number of years. It doesn't get the same.
So she's like 150 years younger than Dan.
Yes, she is. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she's still, yeah, that's what you forget. She's like, I think maybe 29 now. She's still.
No, she's in her 30s.
Is she in her 30s now?
31, maybe, she could. Gabby is now.
Yeah,
she. Age, Gabby. Never.
I mean, she's been on tour for a long time. Doesn't get the same recognition, obviously, as a singles player. But my goodness, her accomplishments are amazing. And we all know that it can come down to doubles sometimes in these types of matches. I mean, if you have one stud singles player wins two matches, you still got to get that third somehow. And it's often comes down to doubles. So, I mean, Gabby, she actually has done a lot for us at the OTA. She's from Ottawa originally, has been terrific, and she's a real proud Canadian. But what are your thoughts on her career and, you know, and how she mixes with the singles players in events like this?
Well, and look, career is remarkable, decorated, all those things. What, two Grand Slam mixed titles, been to a final of Wimbledon, semi of the U.S. Open, twice an Olympian. She says that's her goal. That's the standard she sets for herself. She's, you know, knock on wood, barring injury, going to be at her third one in Paris next summer. I thought one thing that she said in our sit-down interview with Robert Bettauer, she said, I'm not as consumed by results anymore. And I've realized that so much of what goes on results is out of my control. And that's really just helped me, I'm paraphrasing here, but basically extinguish a lot of things. And I thought that was really insightful, that somebody who's a vet, who's been through it, who's been around. There are a lot of things that you can't control that go on. So I thought that those were all significant things. And I think that in 2021, Gabby being honored at City Hall in Ottawa meant a lot to her. I think that she, you know, she's back in her hometown. It was right after the U.S. Open, and the mayor does the commemoration, and I think they named a court in her honor in Ottawa. Like, all those things, I think, have really kind of opened her eyes that I am noticed, I am appreciated. I'm not I'm a Bianca, but I think those all matter.
I agree. And you know, just to blow our own for a second, the OTA, as I said, we've had a great relationship with her, and we've always tried to cover her as much as possible. We've had her on our magazine cover 2 or 3 times, and deservedly so. It's always been about a great triumph, or in the last case, it was really about women in tennis. And I know she's, you know, off the court is very passionate about equal pay, and you know, she thinks a lot about what the future of the game is, I think. And maybe we'll transition into a role like that down the road.
Let's go back in time, like not that long ago. Let's say 2010, you know, back when we were all walking uphill both ways on the way to school. Like, if you said to me there was going to be a player in 2010, like before Milos, before Jeannie, before all of this, there was going to be a women's tennis player who was going to twice be a Grand Slam mixed doubles champion, the argument there would have been at the time that might have made her the most decorated women's tennis player maybe ever in Canada. We've gotten so spoiled so quickly by what's gone on. But I appreciate that we're not letting those significant milestones go unnoticed.
Yeah. Now, you know what? It's been a pleasure to talk to you. I just want to we've talked about these players, all these Canadian players, but what I want to do just for a little fun at the end of this is just to throw the name out of the, you know, the recent players that we know and just get a quick thought or two about them. And I'm going to start with a hard one. He's a great one, but it's Daniel Nestor. That's a handful. That may take half an hour, but what are your, you know, just give me some quick thoughts or memories of watching him and just, you know, just something that we may not know.
The worst fantasy football player you'll ever meet. I think that there's two things about Daniel. One is that it always meant so much to him to represent Canada internationally, Davis Cup, Olympics, etc. I think he ended up with 5 Olympics, I think. Two, such a teammate, and has so much street cred and clout in the locker room. Three, so stubbornly annoying. You know, I remember towards the tail end of his career, we were talking to different guys about Daniel for a piece we were doing. And I just, you know, talking to Andy Murray, and I'm like, you know, Andy, Daniel is one of the most underappreciated Canadian athletes in our country. He's like, no, no, no. He's like, Daniel tells us all the time what a big deal he is in Canada. But the other thing is, this dude worked. Yeah. He'd travel, 12 hours on a flight, change a bunch of time zones, get off the plane, go right to the courts.
Yeah, and a lot of people of a certain, you know, younger than a certain vintage don't realize that he you know, beat Stefan Edberg in singles for Canada and Davis Cup when he was a young man, and he was in, you know, I think top 55 in the world, but, you know, chose doubles, which I think was a good call. Here's another one. Frank the Tank Dantsevich. You obviously have spent a little time with him lately. Give me a couple of tidbits about him.
I'll forever remember Frank for the Granollers match in Vancouver. Frank's a beauty. Frank cares. Frank slugged it out for a lot of years. Like, he was supposed to be the next one, and a lot of challengers and a lot of futures and a lot of traveling on his own, and he did it. But I really believe this. This whole run, the Davis Cup thing, would not have really taken off the way it did if he didn't win that match.
Yeah.
Spain probably wins that tie, and it's back to a qualifier, whatever. But that just changed the whole tenor, the whole attitude of the whole thing.
Yeah, I agree with you. I watched that, and I feel exactly the same way. Like, because he came out of nowhere and played the perfect match, and it gave other Canadians the realization that they could do it, I think. Yeah. Now, we haven't talked about her much. Jeannie Bouchard.
Well, look, that year goes down as just unbelievable, right? Australia semi, French semi. A Canadian woman was in the Wimbledon final. Just wild. So, Bianca's year was amazing, right? Indian Wells, Toronto, and then obviously New York and lifting the trophy. I wonder how impactful Jeannie's 2013 was on what happened in 2019.
Yep, agreed. Yeah. And speaking of 2013, Milos.
Yeah, I mean, there's another guy who reached the Wimbledon final. There's still like disbelief in my voice when I say these things because I still am amazed that it happened. I guess I shouldn't be because of how accomplished it all is, but you know, they were all the firsts.
Yeah.
Jeannie was the first, Milos was the first. And Milos put Canadian tennis on the map. And I really believe this. Like, if it weren't for Milos, I don't think that Dennis and Felix would be what they are. Like, Milos provided the opening, the runway, the idea that this is all possible. Milos was the one that got Canadian sports fans, that got the Canadian consciousness onto tennis. And then Jeannie did the same. And when you're the first to do it, when you're the pioneer in it, that's significant. I don't think Milos is done. I think we're going to see Milos again this year. I think Milos is full on going to give it one last kick at the can. He's got a protected ranking. Why the heck not?
You know what? He's always got a chance on grass, right? With that serve, and that'll...
Wouldn't shock me if we see him in a grass court tune-up and then Wimbledon. How many times have you said this?
Well, you know, I think he spent more than half his career on injured reserve, so maybe there's some freshness there, nothing else. But yeah, a lot of injuries. You know, I want to go through these quickly, but Rebecca Marino, I know you have covered her over the years, and she has an interesting story, but what are a couple of thoughts about her?
Well, I think Rebecca is just one of the great Canadian sports stories, period. Somebody who stepped away, was going through so much, and now here she is, 32 years old, best ranking she's had since her return, doing it on her terms, happy. She's going to go to Madrid and Rome, play those 1,000s for the first time. Has come all the way back and wants it for herself and doing it the way she wants to do it. What a game, too. Big serve, big forehand, focusing on her movement now, improving the backhand. But Rebecca is another like story and inspiration for a lot of people because there are a lot of people going through a lot of crap.
Yep.
And she's showing people that you can scrape yourself up off the mat and go get it again.
Yeah, it is a comeback story, no doubt. Yeah, no doubt.
Absolutely.
Now we talked a little bit about Gabby, so I think we and Layla, we haven't talked too much about Felix. What are your thoughts on him? And you know, what have you seen about him in the last year or two that got him to where he is, and do you think he can take it to the next level?
I saw Felix play for the first time when he was 15 years old, and I said, that's the most talented tennis player I've ever seen, and I really believe that, and I think he's the best tennis player Canada's ever produced. Now he's going to win multiple Grand Slams, and I think that the sky is the limit. He's all of it. He's a dude with his head on his shoulders. He's so smart. He's so athletic. Tennis means so much to him. But it's not everything. He is a well-rounded guy with interests. He can play the piano. He's multilingual. He's, you know, in the old sports, the NFL draft's coming up. They talk about checking boxes. Felix checks all the boxes. The most talented tennis player Canada has ever had. And it's not even close.
And he seems like a real nice guy, too. I mean, he's very grounded, I think.
Yeah, I mean... Family means a lot to him. His circle means a lot to him. He's very grounded. He's very sharp. He's very aware of what's going on around him. You know, I know I just said, the sky is the limit for him. I think it's going to be as interesting, and this is a long way away. I wonder what Felix is going to do after tennis. Like, I could see him being a CEO. I could see him being a commissioner. If this players union takes off, I could see him being the head of a players union. He could get into broadcasting if he wanted. I don't know why anybody would want to do that. there's so much that he could do. And I think that's really cool too.
So we got a couple more. We talked a little bit about Bianca. What just I think it's well documented the kind of personality she is and that sort of thing. What do you think next year or two it holds for her?
I mean, look, the only asterisk around Bianca is health. Like that 2019 was wild for her, and there was so much. She's figuring herself out as a person. And I think she's made a lot of strides in that regard. And once you get that together, then things can come into place with everything else in your life professionally. And I don't mean as an athlete, I just mean as a person. And so Bianca's made big strides that way off the court. She talks about all the gratitude stuff. She talks about all her visualization, all the things she does away from tennis. But she really started to look good again in Miami before the injury. And so much of her outlook now is windshield, not rear view mirror. She's not focused on the past. It's about looking ahead. And I think that's going to do her a ton of work. But I'll say this, outside of Canada winning the 4x100 relay gold in Atlanta, beating those Americans in their own backyard.
Watch it all the time.
Yeah. Glenroy Gilbert blast off and Donovan finishing it off. If you're a Canadian, you gotta love Saturday nights in Georgia. Outside of that, Bianca winning the US Open was, to me, for me personally, the greatest Canadian sports moment. Boom.
Yep. Don't disagree. Now, I left this guy for last because he's a bit of an enigma, but so talented, so charismatic, great player to watch. Dennis, what are your thoughts on Dennis? Like, I know you've interviewed him. I know he had that great triumph against Nadal here in Toronto, but, you know, it's been an up and down few years. What are your thoughts on him?
Incredibly talented. Guy who wants it, and a guy who's just so up and down. Like when he's rocking and rolling, he's still one of the more lethal players on tour. He really is. It's just so hard to stay at that high level so much. Like, I think back to last year's US Open and what that took out of Tiafoe. Physically, mentally, just spiritually exhausted, and it's difficult. And I think Dennis is capable of so much. I really, really do. I don't know what it's going to take for that to happen. I really don't. But there's such a talent there. There's such a flair there. There's such an excitement there. Like, Dennis was made for under the lights. Dennis was not made for, and I know we went to the Wimbledon semifinal, I don't mean this way. Dennis was not made for all whites on an afternoon with strawberries and cream. He was made for New York at midnight, the crowd going nuts and his outfit being wild. And that's where he thrives. That scene in Montreal when he beat Nadal was one of the most electric buildings I've ever been in. And that's what gets his juices pumping. So I think Dennis is on his way to good things, but there just seems to be a couple more parts that have to come together. I just don't know what they are. I'm not a mechanic, I'm not a plumber, I'm not a tennis coach. So I don't know what those puzzle pieces are that he needs to put together.
Well, Arash, I got to tell you, it's been a pleasure talking with you, talking tennis with a guy who's a clear fan of the game and covers it better than anybody in Canada. Keep doing it, because I think the sport can benefit from having insights like people you, and, you know, keep it in front and front and center on television and written word and whatever. But a true pleasure, and thank you very much.
I appreciate it. I'm not, by the way, the best tennis reporter in the country. And I think what's so great is that we actually now have a few. I know we're not supposed to acknowledge our competitors, but the fact that Mark Masters has been such a presence and a fixture at Slams, like, he does such a great job when, for instance, he goes and covers Wimbledon. And it's just so awesome. Mark Rowe has gone down to the US Open. Clara Hanna's gone over to Wimbledon. Carolyn Cameron's called matches for us at Sportsnet. Rob Fault's calls matches for us at Sportsnet. On and on we can go. The fact that we're talking about a bunch, the fact that there's a presence at these places, means a lot. And the players know when they come to us or that other network, I say that tongue in cheek, but when they go talk to Mark or Claire or whomever, they know they're talking to Canada. And it's so different than when they do, you know, when they do others. And so that's kind of cool, because they know they're talking to people who are rooting for them and support them. Not us, the people on the other side of the camera. And I think that's so significant in the whole kind of storytelling of who and what Canadian tennis athletes are all about.
Excellent. And we will see you on the court.
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much.